privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. It is, I'm so sorry, Nick.
Nick,
yes, okay.
Yes, I am Nick. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 6th of 2006. And I just recently celebrated 12 years. 12 years of sobriety. Yeah. My home group is in Kingsburg, though I don't reside there, but my home group is in Kingsburg, and we meet every Monday night at 7:30, and we're called the Beginner's Big Book Study. We are a big book study, and our format is really laid back. We basically start at doctor's opinion, and we basically go through the first three steps. And when we're done, we go back to the beginning. And we encourage everyone to share, as long as we just encourage that they try to stay within what's being read. And we get a lot of questions from a lot of the new people that come in to the meeting sometimes. And we've got some of our members here tonight, Steve and Jane. Appreciate them coming. Steve told me he brought the tomatoes, so I might be doing some dodging and weaving. But yeah, you know, AA is great. You know, I've experienced the ups and downs in AA for 12 years. And, you know, as far as where I come from, what it was like, I'm originally from Toledo, Ohio, and I grew up in AA. I grew up in AA because my dad sobered up back in 83, and I was about 10 or 11. So as soon as he got sober, you know, the kids got into Alateen, and we did, you know, family counseling. And what was really interesting about my childhood is, you know, I learned a lot about alcoholism. Through family therapy, I learned what it did to the family. And, you know, looking, you know, in retrospect, I think, you know, my dad meant well. You know, I know my dad really wanted the family to heal, but it really didn't deter me from drinking. You know, eventually I did drink, and I became all the things that I swore that I never would become. You know, witnessing, you know, even at a young age, seeing, you know, my dad was, you know, I come from an Italian-Irish family, and my dad was the cool guy, man. My dad was a bar owner. You know, he had casinos down in the basements of his bars. He had adult bookstores. I mean, he was like the personification of like what you see in Goodfellas, you know. And I really looked up to him when he was drinking and when he quit. And, you know, it was really, really neat about my dad when he quit. He let all that stuff go. You know, that definitely really combated with his spirit, you know, that, you know, he couldn't hang on to that type of lifestyle anymore. But, you know, when he got sober, you know, and I started going into Alateen, I definitely saw a different dad. And what was sort of neat is I didn't really spend a lot of time with him when he was doing his bar thing, you know, and booking and all that. And but when he got into AA, I got to spend some time with my dad and got to know a lot of people in AA at a young age and did picnics and everything like that. So I can really familiarize myself with the camaraderie of AA, and that was something that I really learned to appreciate before I became, you know, the alcoholic that I am today. And I'm not really sure what it took for me to go from the Alateen meeting to sitting down with my dad in a meeting, but it did happen. And, you know, I think with my drinking, I was always a head scratcher with my drinking, even in high school. You know, I noticed that when I went to parties, I definitely drank to get drunk, you know, that's what I was thinking, you know, and I drank until I puked, and I would puke and then I could drink more. But what started happening is I would go into these blackouts in these parties. I would go into blackouts when I'd be down at Willie's Park, you know, in Toledo in you know, five below weather, you know, and wake up and not know what happened. And, you know, I started realizing then that, you know, well, maybe I just need a drink like the rest of my friends, you know. And I remember at parties just consciously saying to myself that, okay, I'm with Tom. I'm going to just stay where Tom's at. When Tom grabs a beer, I'm going to grab a beer. If he's taking a break, I'm going to take a break. But that's not what happened, even in high school, man. It's like I took a drink, and then the drink took a drink, you know. So I noticed, you know, this lack of control early on. The one thing that I didn't notice yet, and it took until I was in my 20s, was where it got so bad where I felt like now I got to quit. You know, it just wasn't objectionable to me yet. And when it did become objectionable, it was already too late for me. You know, that's what happened. You know, I remember being in my 20s and, you know, having this girlfriend, fiance, and never saving a dime for our wedding, you know, and looking back at it. I mean, I had all the sincerity in the world to be a better, you know, boyfriend and be able to save for that wedding and all that type of stuff. But, you know, here's a girl, you know, just in her early 20s, basically having to babysit me when we go to bed. You know, I'm drunk. She's constantly waking up, making sure that, you know, I'm not asphyxiating on my vomit because I tend to, you know, sleep on my back. And there were times she had to push me over to my side. And, but, you know, I was in bands. I was a rock and roller. That's the way you're supposed to be, right? And sort of like how Bill talks about how it helped him with his business. You know, it sort of goes hand in hand when you're playing in bars all the time, you know, and you're living that type of lifestyle. And in sort of a sick way, I think, you know, that's what she was into in a way, too. You know, I think she was sort of into that. She just didn't sign on to the whole 100% of it. You know, she liked, you know, going out to bars and watching me play and the camaraderie and the bar scene and stuff like that. But when it was time to come home, you know, she really had to take care of me. She really was my caretaker. And I remember, you know, in my 20s, I was thinking, man, you know, maybe it's time to go back to AA. You know, I really want to quit. And like I said, when I woke up to that idea, when I woke up to that clarity that, you know what, this is insane. You know, the way I'm living, you know, I'm suffering even when I'm not drinking from this internal condition that we have. It's like, this has got to stop. It just has to stop. And man, if you hooked me up to a lie detector test and a guy said, Mr. Capoletti, are you going to quit drinking? And I said, yes, I would pass it. I mean, that's how much I meant it. But it could be 2 days. It could be a week. It could be a month. All of a sudden, that insidious idea that insanity would creep up on me that would tell me that, you know what, I think it's okay for you to drink. You know, what, maybe it was because I'm not getting so much flack from my boss, you know, my brother at work, you know, or Pearl is, you know, not getting on me, you know, and I'm just being good, you know, and you can only be good for so long, man. And it goes to your head and you think that you're okay. So I'd go back and do it again. And I do it again, and I did it again, and I did it again. And the more I sunk, because the thing is that incomprehensible demoralization, right, is waking up to the fact every single time that, oh my God, I can't do this, man. I mean, is this, you know, it gets to a point when you keep trying over and over to stop where finally, you know, that hopelessness just becomes just apathy, you know, at least hope, you know, hopelessness for me, you almost get comfortable with it after a while. That was my experience. It was like, this is, you know what? You hand me a beer. It's like roulette, man. You know, I could stop at 2. I could stop at 6. I could stop at a nightly spree. It might take a week. You know, who knows? You know, let's put some bets down, you know. But that's how I drank, man. I just did not know what was going to happen when I drank. I remember one time, I split a bottle of wine with my wife and my in-laws. And that was it. I had that bottle of wine between 4 people, and man, that was it. And I held on to that time for years, man, thinking, man, if I did it this time, I'm going to do it again. And I didn't do it again. I swear I could probably count on one hand out of my drinking career where I literally was able to control the amount I drank once I put it in my system. You know, and I definitely could not swear it off for good. You know, so an alcoholic like me, you know, completely repeating time and time again, you know, that incomprehensible demoralization and knowing that, you know, knowing that I can't quit, you know, that apathy that I had, you know, and so I'm not even fighting it anymore, right? And that lasted, you know, I sobered up still fairly young. I sobered up at 33 or 34. And I remember I got a few years back in 2000. I got a few years, and I got a sponsor, and I did the steps, and he took me through to the best of his ability. I went through them to the best of my ability, and I was able to get a few years. But one thing that I do remember, is eventually, you know, something started happening internally in me. You know, it didn't matter how many meetings I was going to. It didn't matter how many people in AA I was talking to. It didn't matter if I was doing a secretary position or a treasury position or whatever it was. Something inside me just started, lack for a better word, just started dying, man. The more I still was around these people, the more my spirit still separated from those people. I separated from them. And I got to a point where it was like, okay, you're sober, Nick, but maybe you're crazy. You know, you're sober, but you're still feeling depressed, full of misery, fear. You know, there's a page on there's a page in the Big Book, page 52. I'm sure some of you are familiar with it. And I was living on page 52, and I remember that idea coming in my head about, well, if I'm crazy, well, then maybe it is okay to drink. And when I took that drink, I went on one of the most hellacious roller coaster rides for 7 years. And my addictions took such twists and turns. You know, I had a bad back. So not only did I go back to drinking, but I was taking heavy amounts of narcotics. You know, I was physically addicted to these things. And I mean, so physically addicted that I remember a doctor telling me, Nick, he goes, those patches that you're wearing, if I were to put the amount of patches that's on your arm on somebody just walking by, they'd be dead in like an hour and a half. I mean, that's how sedated on narcotics I was. And I was drinking. I was still drinking. And I remember, man, I mean, I literally spent probably 7 years laying on a couch, man. I mean, 7 years is a master's degree. You know what I mean? I wasted 7 years of just drinking and being physically addicted and continuously using narcotics. And something happened. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like I just was stuck on, it's like someone just put me on like this train track. And it was just going towards a wreck, but someone placed me on it. You know, it's like, I don't know how to explain it any other way. I just remember that the pills got so far out of hand that Dawn and I ended up being in, obviously, you know, sometimes divorce comes into the conversations, you know, and they did. And I remember Dawn coming to me and just saying, Nick, something's got to give, man. And she wanted to do some counseling. I said, okay, let's do some counseling. And I remember the first day that we saw her, her name was Lisa. I didn't have to say much at all. She said, dude, you're addicted to drugs and alcohol. And I definitely was physically addicted to those drugs. And I go, well, maybe, you know. And I remember she held on to my medication. And Lisa said, give the medication back to him. So I ended up getting it back. And it only took 2 nights for Dawn to wake up. She was on the phone. And she saw me on the couch. And I had some foam coming out of my mouth. Well, I sometimes fell asleep with food in my mouth. And she wasn't thinking anything of it. She wiped my mouth, my lips, and she went outside to talk to her friend. Well, when she came in, I had that phone coming out again. So sure enough, they tried waking me up, her and my daughter, and I wouldn't wake up. My eyes are flipping to the top of my head and rolling back and just can't wake up. So the paramedics are called, but they have to take my freaking, you know, weight, you know, my dead weight body off the couch. And the paramedics comes to work on me, and they told my wife, they said, you know, if we would have been 10 minutes too late, I mean, he already stopped breathing. I would have been dead. I mean, I literally was this close to dying. And I didn't do any more drinking or any more drugs than any other night. So it was just weird how it just happened. And I remember all of a sudden waking up in emergency, and it's some big black doctor that I had seen, you know, 2 months before for pancreatitis due to my drinking. He just looks down at me and says, "Mr. Capoletti, I think you might have a problem with alcohol, you know, and drugs." And I go, well, I just thought of it as bad luck. I just took too much, and I just need to go home, and everything will be okay. But for some reason, like I said, I was on that train track, and before I know it, I'm in detox. And then I'm detoxing off alcohol, and then they give me Librium, you know, to help with the withdrawal. And it was just sort of like it took a mind of its own. And before I knew it, I'm sober, knowing that I got to go back to AA. And that's what I did. I went back to AA. But I remember this hopeless feeling that came over me when I knew I had to come back to AA was, I tried AA. You know, I really thought that I had tried it. You know, I really thought that I had experienced it at all levels, you know, and I thought I did the best that I could, and I still ended up drinking, you know. So I ended up hooking up with my old sponsor, and he got me a job. So, you know, within the first month or so of me being sober, I was working. And I did AA, you know, the way I usually did it, you know, all my life for about a year, you know, and thank God, you know, I was able to stay sober. But like I said, something was happening inside me internally again, man. Here's an example. I remember at the end of that year, and at the end of that first year, I remember my wife and my daughter, we were going to Fresno to see a movie. And I remember 180, when it only went as far as Clovis, I remember getting on, and some guy cut me off on 180. And man, I just tailgated him all the way to River Park area. I don't even really even remember. I don't even know what the hell I would have done if he would have pulled over. I mean, it could have been like four dudes that lift weights, you know. And I didn't care, man. I saw red, but it was family day. You know what I mean? And I'm just irate. And all of a sudden, it was like I woke up from possession all of a sudden. And I was just like, man, I'm just like, I'm freaking nuts. You know, I'm just nuts. And I had a buddy of mine that was working with an old friend that I got in the program back in 2000. His name's David Marquez, and he's a big book dumper. And Bobby, my buddy, you know, was working with them. And I just noticed a difference in him. And I noticed a serenity. And, you know, he stopped gossiping like with, you know, that's the thing. We could hang out and just talk shit about AA. You know, or go to AA meetings that just had tons of drama. I mean, that's how I lived for a year. You know, if I'm going to go to an AA meeting, I want to be entertained to some degree, you know, and that is sick. But the thing is, I saw a change in him, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to talk to Dave. I'm going to go to their meeting. And I have to admit, man, when I went to that meeting, it definitely, I walked away with some considerations. And those considerations were, you know, maybe I really don't know what an alcoholic is. Maybe, you know, I definitely know that I drank too much. But I mean, really, what does it mean to the innermost self what an alcoholic is? You know, and being able to get to the point where you see the destruction to where now you have to seek the power that's in step two. So, like I said, it was just like I was on autopilot. I just, you know, it's like I lasted that year by the grace of God, and now all of a sudden I'm working with Dave, and I would meet at his house once a week, and we would start going through the work, and he would always challenge any preconceived ideas that I had. And, you know, like I said, number one thing was, man, you know, I really didn't understand what step one was all about. I mean, to its fullest, you know, I think we owe it to ourselves to a degree that, you know, if we're going to come into this and we're going to be working with others and we're going to be sort of taking on that responsibility, using God's power, you know, I better know something about this disease. You know, I really need to have something to offer that person, you know. And those were the things that was really beginning to dig at me and really make me look at some hard questions. Because, you know, I did AA all my life, like I said. You know, I started at 11 all the way up until I was 33. And I had a lot of ideas of what AA was all about. And I had to come to the, you know, I had to come to the conclusion that, you know, Nick, maybe you don't know that much. You know, maybe you don't. And maybe it's time you listen. And that's what I did. I did a lot of listening. You know, there wasn't a lot of talking in those sessions with Dave. You know, it was a lot of uncomfortability. There were times that I was hoping that he would just cancel, you know, so that we didn't have to meet, you know, and... But I got through it, you know, and we got all the way through. We got all the way through the steps to where I was writing inventory, and I was getting clear on some inventory. And then before I know it, I was doing an amends list. And then now I'm actually knocking on people's doors. I'm making approaches. And what's amazing about this is when you really look at the whole package, you know. I mean, look at your experience. You know, for me, I knew that I could not keep myself sober no matter what. There was nothing I personally could do to keep myself sober. And I also mean in AA. I couldn't do that in AA. Okay, I couldn't just think that, you know, going to meetings is going to fix my internal condition. You know, how many cups of coffee can I pour to get closer to God, right? I stopped looking at things that way. More than anything, when I looked at my experience, you know, I was thinking, wow, you know, did I choose to get sober or did God remove me from the drinking problem? Is this God? Because if I've lost all power in drink, then why do I have a sobriety date? You know, does this have anything to do with me or does it have everything to do with God? You know, did God remove me from alcohol to be of maximum service to others or am I choosing to stay sober today? Because the thing that I do, this is the challenging part of choice, is choice and powerlessness cannot coexist in the same area, right? If I'm choosing, that's my power. If I'm powerless, I've lost power and control and choice. So that's what I always remember, you know, is, you know, if there's a higher power in my life, he's big enough to have separated me between me and alcohol. You know, and when you really think of it in that way, I mean, what work really do we have? Well, the work is seeking. You know, that's the thing, you know, when a big book thumper like me is in the meeting, one of the first things that I say is, man, I'm not perfect. You know, this isn't about God just keeping me sober and I just sit down. I mean, there is a lot that I've got to do to stay spiritually connected. It's not that easy. You know, I have an agnostic temperament. And if I'm not doing what I need to be doing, okay, Nick's going to start doing what he thinks he needs to do. Plain and simple. You know, if I'm not basking in the sunlight of God's Spirit, well, then I'm basking in the sunlight of my spirit. And I know where that gets me. Right? It's either living selflessly or selfishly. Right? And that's what I learned through the course of these steps. But, you know, what I really wanted to share about tonight is, you know, it's like, what's happened in my life since I found the solution that's really worked in my life? You know, and what preconceived ideas have I let go of even after getting the solution? You know, when I got this solution, I mean, and I learned all this stuff about alcoholism and what the big book had to offer. Man, I just would come into meetings with my spiritual hammer, man. I mean, it would just come down. It's like, no, you're wrong. This is right. You know, I know what the solution is. And it just isn't effective. You know, I would grind an axe even telling the truth. You know, and I remember just thinking, man, I just can't wait till people get the solution that I found. you know. And not knowing the whole time that they probably did. You know, that they probably did, just in their own way. You know, I remember, I think, the beginning of my growth in a way where it sort of began to get away from the collective. You know, collective thinking, I hate collective thinking, you know. Politically, spiritually, you know, even in AA, you know, when I just don't like it when I'm in a big group where we're all thinking the same, man. It begins to tug at me and makes me think, you know, am I following a group or am I following God? And I remember reading No Man Is an Island, and I was reading that daily, and it's Thomas Merton, and if no one's ever heard of him, he was a Catholic monk. And I was raised Lutheran, so I'm not Catholic, but, you know, the guy just, man, it just resonated with me on his essays. And one thing that he shared that really began to make me look at some new ideas was autonomy, right? Autonomy. So God speaks to me. I work my program. You know, I tend to emulate, I tend to sort of do it the way the co-founders did. You know, that's the way I do it. That's what works for me. But it's like God started showing me that, you know, listen, man, it's like everybody has their own autonomy. Everybody has their own path. Everybody has their own relationship with God or higher power of their own understanding. And I remember starting to wake up to that idea that, you know what, you know, maybe I'm not coming at this with a lot of humility. You know, maybe I really need to be more tactful at the way I share. You know, maybe I've been wrong. You know, and I remember when I started going through these changes, you know, I was participating in a home group here in Visalia for years and was really serious about it, and it meant so much to me. And I started having these ideas. Well, not even ideas, man, because ideas are usually my ideas. But I was just hearing an intuitive voice telling me, you need to go. And man, I just fought with that voice for like 3 years. And I was like, I can't go. I mean, this is where you want me. I've seen people leave this meeting and they come back after 3 months with their tail between their legs saying, man, I shouldn't have left this meeting. So, I mean, even the fear of that was coming over me. Like, this is where I belong. This is where I belong. But it kept eating at me. And it kept eating at me. And I can't put words to it, man, other than God was speaking and I was fighting. And I remember my last time as a member in that meeting. And I thought to myself, you know what? This is probably going to be my last meeting. And but God didn't even let that happen. I got up in the middle of the meeting, and I remember my buddy calling me saying, hey, is everything okay? Everything okay? And I go, yeah, everything is okay, man. But you know what came to mind as soon as I left that meeting? I'm going to start my own meeting. I'm going to start my own meeting. You know, and it doesn't have to be big. It can stay small. But as long as we're working with others and being of maximum service to others, you know what? Let's do it. I want to do it. And before I know it, man, I had that meeting. I had the meeting, and I've been secretarying it ever since. It's about time we get a new secretary. Huh, Steve? But it's been a ride, man. And, you know, that's the thing. You know, I guess that's a consideration to you is, you know, if you got some time in this program and you're feeling like you're doing the right thing, but your gut is telling you to do something completely opposite, you may want to listen to your gut. You know, and I don't even know what that would even pertain to with you. You know, I that's one thing I thought to myself. I go, when I speak tonight, man, I just really want to just sort of freestyle, man. I didn't come up here tonight thinking, okay, this is how I'm going to start. This is what the middle is going to look like. This is what the end is going to look like. I was just like, you know, I meditated and prayed and meditated before I came. I said, God, I am just a vessel, man. Just, I am going to share. If I bomb tonight, it was because you wanted me to bomb tonight, you know. So all the responsibilities on him. So, but, you know, that's the thing. You know, I think more than anything, out of my speaking tonight is that there's so much growth that can take place. And probably 90% of the time, we can't really ever put a finger on what's happening. By the time we wake up to one thing, another thing is already starting to take place. You know, it's like they say one door closes and another one opens, or however the saying goes. That stuff is happening and I'm not even conscious to it. You know, I thought about it. You know, I remember in the beginning, I remember it was so important to have a conception of God, of this higher power. And I remember clinging on to Father and Sunlight of the Spirit. I loved those two terms in the big book. And I held on it for so long until all of a sudden it dawned on me that maybe it's better to experience God than have an idea of God. You know, because the thing is, if I hang on to a particular conception of God, it's almost like trying to measure a line that's constantly being drawn, right? So you've got this idea of God, but if you're growing, it's already gotten this big. So now you've gotten over here, now you've got this idea of God, now it's gotten this big. Now you begin worshiping this, now it turns back to this. You know, that's been my experience with God, is that the only time I feel truly fulfilled in the Sunlight of the Spirit, or when I can look at Him as Father, is when I'm experiencing Him in the present. And like I said, man, when I share that tonight, it is not easy. It is so hard. It is so hard. You know, I've been tried lately with, you know, I've got a business that is just exploding. You know, I'm doing well financially. I never thought in a million years that I would own my own business, that it would start, you know, going throughout the state. You know, I never thought that I would be able to manage, you know, that my God could manage my family life, my work life, and my spiritual life, but He does it. But man, it has just been, it is just such a ride, you know. I mean, if I'm not in awe, I'm just completely lost. It like goes back and forth, you know. But I just, you know, I just look at some of the things that have happened in my life, man. You know, I lost a dad, you know. But when I went back to bury my dad, I was able to do a graveside amends with my mom. So it's just amazing the things that can happen from devastating experiences. You know, it's just amazing how God works. It's almost like I don't need to create balance in my life, because in the midst of chaos, God still creates whatever balance He wants, and I'm okay with it. Right? I don't believe that I have any more power over my emotions than I do over whether I choose a drink or not. You know, I'm one of those type of cats. I'm one of those type of guys that believes that if I stay diligent in the spiritual principles of the program, so that means all three sides of the triangle. That means that I'm praying and meditating. I'm continuously 10-stepping throughout the day. I'm participating in a home group, and I'm taking people through the work. As long as I'm doing all that stuff, God fixes everything. The moment I start thinking that, you know what? Don said I'm selfish today. Well, I'm going to work on my selfishness. Yeah, I'm lying a little bit. I think I'm going to work on my lying. Well, that's almost like me saying, you know what? I'm drinking too much. I'm going to work on my drinking. So if I don't have power over my drinking, what makes me think that I've got power over really anything else? Now, I do have power over aspirin. You know, if I've got a headache, I know I can take 2 aspirin. I'm not going to take 4 or 6 or 8, right? So there are certain things that I choose to do. And I think I can go as far as I think I choose to seek God today. You know, it talks about it being a choice in the big book. And, but it's amazing that, you know, the paradox that the powerlessness in step one that I found brings me to the power in the choice of seeking that God in step two. So just because I'm powerless over drink today and I've lost choice and I know I lost control, God still provides a power within me that can be of maximum service to others. And to me, that is something that I could not do in my own power. So for you newcomers, I really welcome you with open arms. You know, I hope that you guys can find what I found and what others have found in this room. Because if you don't, you're not special. And what I mean by that is eventually you'll succumb to something that's not really good, whether it's death or incarceration or going into a sane asylum or just dying miserably sober. You know, that's one thing that I've learned about this disease, people, is that this disease doesn't need you drinking to take you out. It doesn't need you to drink to take you out. Because really what we suffer from is an internal condition that alcohol fixed for many years. But eventually it stops fixing that. And that internal condition, in my case, in my experience, got sicker and sicker and sicker. And people talk about bottoms. Well, as long as you have a shovel, that bottom can constantly be keep getting dug. You know, for me, I mean, bottom is probably death for me, man. You know, I'm watching a brother of mine succumb to this disease. You know, and it's heartbreaking. And it's heartbreaking to know that there's nothing I can do about his drinking. There's nothing I can do to separate my brother from his alcohol. The only thing that can intervene is divine intervention between him and alcohol. So, as I speak up here, there might be some people in here that have a problem with the word God, or maybe choose to stay sober. Well, keep trying it out. Maybe it'll work. You know, my case, you know, the idea of seeking God and not being ready led me back through those doors, and alcohol brought me right back in. So that's all I got tonight. So thank you for letting me share.